The invisible hand contains sensitive material that could threaten the safety of our contributors. To protect the identities of those involved, we will mostly be using first names or pseudonyms. Content warning. This series contains graphic audio relating to animal cruelty and some violent themes, which may be distressing to some listeners. These episodes were written to be listened to chronologically. This is Chapter 5. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others.
Imagine a paradigm in which all life flows in a great chain of being. Within that chain, an entity's placement determines its worth. If you believe in a god, he resides at the top and rules over all. Then comes the earthbound body with the most power, the white man. Great kings, priests, scholars, and warriors alike. Then the white woman. Then the other, with a capital O, the remaining human lives. Then comes what is known as the animal kingdom, which human beings are separate from and dominate. Within that kingdom, lives are also hierarchized. The white rhino would be nearing the top tier, followed by non-predatory animals. Then those we relate to as food. Then comes insects, plants and microorganisms, and then the earth itself. Are you imagining? I'm Georgina Savage, and this is The Invisible Hand. Chapter 5. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Where are we, Ben?
We're at the Rhino Sanctuary. We're going to go meet Sophia and Benjamin the rhino.
And Sophia's named after you, Sophia?
Yes.
Are you excited?
Yeah. And Sophia's only my friend.
No, she isn't. She's all of ours. This is my dad's fifth, so he's been here four other times, I think.
But sometimes when he comes here, it's to drop off rhinos.
Yeah.
We are at Care for Wild Rhino Sanctuary, the largest rhino sanctuary in the world. It's not too far from the Kruger and is where rangers such as Greg take orphaned calves whose mothers have been poached.
Hello, how are you? Nice to meet you.
Nice meeting you.
Hi,
nice
I'm Georgina. Nice to meet you. Thanks so
much. The property forms part of the 28,000 hectares of the Barberton Nature Reserve. It's a wonderful sprawling landscape with rolling hills, dense forests and thick red dirt. This area harbours the second highest known plant species diversity in southern Africa.
Renamed to Benjamin without us knowing it.
Really?
Yeah.
But he was so excited when he heard that. He was like, oh, so now you have
two. Now, well, now you guys have two. Your whole freaking family is
exactly.
On. So that's amazing. So we can let them meet both.
We're here to visit the first rhino calf Greg saved early on in his time as a section ranger. He named her Sophia. Sophia's mother had been poached, and Sophia was also injured in the process, probably because she was getting in the way. After the hunt, alone in the bush, Sophia was attacked by hyenas and her ear bitten. When Greg and his team found her, she was exhausted, traumatized, and alone. She was helicoptered over to Care for Wild, where Petronelle and her team nursed Sophia back to health.
Is that her?
Yeah, see how her ear was bitten off. That is, I think, she's not. That can't be Sophia. That's too big, huh? That's too big. I mean, she fitted into the heli like no problem. She'd never get into a helicopter now, huh?
She's that's so cool.
Huh?
That's so cool.
How do you feel, Greg?
Yeah, it's so nice. I mean, you know, it's like this is the, you know, the good side of this, of what's going on. You know, the fact that we've got these people like Petronelle doing, you know, in her team to do this is just amazing.
Oh, they're going to feed it. It's strange to think that they were all once tiny little babies just hanging around their dead mum.
With them, yeah, yeah. Yeah, eight rhinos, you know, eight rhino mums. But actually, it probably, you can times that by four or five. You consider how many rhinos per adult, you know, how many rhinos we've actually lost.
The only thing I could do from my point of view is be so respectful and so humbled by the opportunity to help save an iconic species. Because think about it, they've been here for 15 million years. How can they go extinct on our watch? What will that say of us? So everyone that have hands and have willing hands needs to take hands and make 100% sure that in our generation, this iconic species does not go extinct.
This is Petronelle Newwood. She runs Care for Wild. She was raised by a teacher and a farmer in what she described as an untouched area in the Lowveld that is now World Heritage listed, not far from where the sanctuary is. She's a real leader and extremely dedicated to her cause. It's almost as if she was born to do this, or at least that's how she sees it. Petronelle is quite a famous character in the anti-poaching game. Everyone told me to come and see her. Going back to when you were a child, were you exposed to animals a lot? Where did this kind of fierce passion for wanting to protect animals come from?
I think it's just a sticker that God gave me and say, okay, there's a sticker. You will look after my creation. I think you can do this. You have a lot of energy and you have a lot of leadership abilities and organization skills. And for this, you can ask me for this. So you go and you just do this. And it's an unbelievable journey. If animals let you into their world, it is something else. You cannot explain to people how special that is when an animal realizes, but you're actually part of us. You understand our language. So I think I've been very privileged working with this mega fauna herbivores and seeing a little bit of their heart. I do believe that, yes, we are the intelligent species, but why are we then struggling to save a species? Are we not focused on the wrong stuff? We're sitting here and we can listen to the hippos playing in the water. We want to go to the moon and I'd like these people going to the moon. But we still need to save the species, because if we don't save the species, how are we going to save this planet for ourselves?
Do you sort of feel like there's a knock-on effect if you kind of decide, okay, well, maybe we'll just let the rhino go, then maybe we'll just let the lion go, then we'll just let the hippo go, then it will be a domino effect and the kind of other species that depend on that animal in the ecosystem will also crumble and it will just be like a rapid pace decline?
Oh, absolutely, I've seen it. You know, when we started with the rhino sanctuary at Care for Wild, you get the rhinos in and you start releasing them in areas and you see how they activate land. They're keystone species, they're mega herbivores. They're very important, because if we look after your rhino and your white rhino, black rhino, elephant, if you look what their job is in the ecosystem, they knock trees over, they open areas, you know, if I talk now about elephant. And then your dikers can eat, your insects can live. If there's insects, there's the insect eating birds. So it will be a sad situation if we don't understand the knock-on effect, the domino effect of losing one rhino. And saying this, I did nothing in my lifetime. I will see a big five reserve decline to a big three reserve. What is that? So if you think about rescuing a baby rhino, that's basically a sentence, but it's a whole world. It is the pilot, it's a veterinarian, it's the rangers, it is the helicopter, it is the equipment, it is, you're talking big.
And where do you think that passion comes from? Like, what is it about these animals that everyone seems to be, I'm really grappling with
What is it about the rhino? Is it just because the rhino is going extinct that everyone cares about the rhino so much? Or is there something more to it that I need to understand?
There's definitely something more. You know, if you look at them when they're born, it is absolute magic. It looks like they come out of a dinosaur egg. Underneath their feet, it looks like roots. They grew from the earth. They're part of what's happening every day. There must be unbelievable communication and energies flowing. And sometimes you feel some of it and it almost washed over you. You know what? The sounds I make, they have four languages. It never stop hearing them talk. Sometimes just the way they move their bodies, sometimes their ears. Sometimes, you know what, just a slight change in the shades of the eyes. The blue rings around the eye, you know. They definitely smile and they definitely are playful. It is something else to work with this animal. It is an overwhelming feeling that sometimes you can't explain. It short breaths you when you see the pain that they have to go through. Like if we talk about Sophia, it felt like someone grabbed my heart and squeezed the blood out of it. So much pain I felt, she projected towards me and say, please help me, this is too much for one body. You know, the loss of my mom, it was hard enough. And to see, and then the hyenas attacked us, and I wanted to protect my mom, and I couldn't, and they attacked me as well. And then suddenly, you know, I came out of that, and I tried to join the group of rhinos, a cross of rhinos, and they attacked me. What must I do with this? Please let me rather die. I don't know what to do with that immense trauma and pain that's sitting in this small little body.
This is Georgina, and she's from Australia.
Hello.
Hello.
And she's going to visit us for a while.
Here I am at Ben's grade 3 class. This is an Afrikaans school in Skukuza, the main camp of the Kruger, where most of the park employees' kids attend. There are roughly 40 kids in this class, all packed like sardines in a mash of tables, chairs, school bags and lunch boxes. It's colourful in here. The walls are covered with kids' drawings, cartoons with timetables, posters of animals. Most of the kids are black. Ben sticks out, being one of the 5 white kids here. He waves to me proudly when I arrive. It's boiling hot and there are fans whirring.
I started reading a beautiful story to you, but it ended on a rather sad note. So today, we're going to read further because we love stories that end nice and happily ever after, don't we? Yes, don't you like a story that ends happily?
We do.
We do. Now, let's listen further. The baby rhino was left behind because his mother had been poached for her horn.
His teacher, unbeknownst to me, has set up a special class. She knows I'm making a documentary about rhino poaching and decides to focus the lesson plan around that fact.
And we hear a lot about a rhino that had been killed for its horn. What do you think about that? Hands up. Ben?
I don't think it feels nice because it's an endangered species. That means they are almost extinct.
Okay, Ben, done. What do you say?
I think that it's not nice for the environment because other people like to see animals and rhinos and all extinct animals that will be extinct, but I think they won't.
Okay, and Hanley, what do you say? How do you feel?
I don't actually like it when they poach the rhinos, because we need rhinos for our environment, because one day when we are big and we have kids, then they also want to know what rhinos are, and then we can't actually see it because they'll be extinct.
We don't see the rhinos that much because they're being poached a lot of times.
And how do you feel about that?
I feel sad about it.
Why?
Because they're busy poaching them and busy selling their horns.
And Rita Bile, what do you know about rhino horns?
Because they can save their kids.
Right? Because they can save their kids. Do you think so? Do you think it's true?
No.
No, because rhino horns are just like our
nails.
Our nails. And who are medicine that's made of nails? That's terrible. I don't want to drink that. Why would you drink that? Exactly. So let's fold our arms and let's listen to the story further.
The stories we're told define our view of the world. Media and entertainment, like most industries, profits in part from selling stories that support the agenda of those who pay the bills. The story of poaching isn't a new one, but the way it's often represented, at least by most mainstream accounts, paints a fairly one-dimensional picture.
And we head back to Africa for details on the death of a suspected animal poacher.
Officials at Kruger National Park in South Africa say the man was killed by an elephant last week. They found his gun and ammunition. They also claim that most of his body was devoured by lions, with only his pants left behind.
A poacher who snuck into a national park in South Africa probably won't be sneaking back out. That's because he was trampled by elephants and then served as dinner to a pack of hungry lions.
There's a story out of South Africa, and in this particular story, the animals struck back. The animals are sick and tired of poachers coming in and trying to murder them in their natural
habitat. Well, a suspected rhino poacher is dead, and park rangers say he was killed by elephants. They say there's evidence that a pride of lions ate the poacher. Oof. I know I put that on social media, and I got a lot of karma comments. Uh-huh. So. Mm-hmm.
So according to the New York Times, listen to this. Mm-hmm. Rhino poacher was killed by an elephant.
Oh, yeah.
And eaten by lions.
It's been a good week.
You know, I figure like if you're killing animals and you get killed by animal, vigilante justice.
Listening to these clips back now, I can vividly remember the first time I heard this story. I was watching a viral news report. A news report in which a poacher was mauled by a lion. I watched as the social media storm swirled violently around the piece. I read comment after comment celebrating the loss of this man's life. People who had likely never been to South Africa or Mozambique and never would, but had their own justified understanding of what was going on in this scenario of lion kill man trying to kill rhino. In one sense, I get it. There is something satisfying about feeling the world is in balance, like there are forces which take care of such things. It's a comforting idea because it alleviates both personal and group responsibility. Like there is some ultimate purveyor of justice, ensuring everything remains right in the world. We in the West have a tendency to fantasize Africa. We are obsessed with this idea of it as untouched earth, full of wildlife, good people singing in gospel choirs, and bad people enacting violence, like poaching. Reporting like that of the previous clips plays into this conceptualization with their portrayal. And as our response demonstrates, we eat it up. George Orwell wrote in his famous novel Animal Farm, "All animals are created equal, but yeah, some animals are more equal than others."
Yeah, but I think there was like three of them this time. And so they're so noisy when they get in the water. You can be in a dead sleep and you can hear them getting in the water. And then the lions were having a really good time with each other.
Oh, yeah, I had it.
Yeah.
I had it.
Yeah, me too. So I didn't sleep.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's like being next to a party room at the hotel. That's what it was like last night.
In 1976, Dean McCannell said that tourism is a quest for an evasive authenticity. McCannell suggests that tourists, disenchanted by the apparent inauthenticity of their lives, are searching for more real experiences, perhaps by visiting non-Western cultures they understand as traditional. However, they are doomed only to find a staged authenticity. This form of dramatic production, which typically might be a dance show or a craft demonstration, organised by local hosts to satisfy tourist desires, is merely a front stage commercial performance that is part of the tourist product they are destined to consume. It may well be, argues McCannell, that authenticity resides in backstage areas.
There's five of them, I think. One male and four females. No, two males. Two males and three females.
I've left Tam and Greg's and travelled a few hours north, out of the Kruger, to a private game reserve adjacent to the park. I'm on a morning drive with a group of tourists from the US and the Netherlands. This reserve has private lodges for those seeking a more luxurious experience of the bush.
She's very relaxed. I dare someone go up and pet her in the belly.
My name is Mike, and I operate a game lodge in the Greater Kruger area. Greater Kruger being the Kruger National Park with the private nature reserves fenced in with the Kruger National Park. So open system, and the game can move freely between the two areas.
I'm here because of an incident which occurred last year and one which has scarred the lodge and its staff. Mike isn't his real name, by the way. We can't name the lodge or the owner or the other staff members because of what went down.
There was a private reserve, part of the Greater Kruger area, that had staff members being recruited by poachers, middlemen who were trying to get them involved. They were getting involved, and that reserve lost a whole lot of rhino in a very short space of time. What could they do to counteract this? What system can they put in place to stop this from happening? They started doing polygraphs. The polygraph would indicate that someone's like needs to be looked at, and then that it would do a second polygraph. If they failed two consecutive polygraphs, then it was deemed that you were confirmed to be a suspect and not fit to work in this environment. Then, because it was a private reserve, not a government reserve, we could negotiate a system with the unions, because they also have the same interest at heart to keep rhinos safe for the good of everybody, because it's jobs for everybody and it's a national asset, and it's good for the local community and good for the people who work here. They understood that value, so the unions agreed to it, the system that was put in place.
So the system was implemented. If you failed two consecutive polygraph tests, which were done at random, you'd be banned from the reserve. And since you were banned from the reserve, you couldn't work there anymore because you couldn't access your place of employment.
It proved very, very successful, because that reserve that had lost a lot of rhino, when that policy was put in place, it stopped everything, like overnight. And a whole lot of people were banned from the reserve, and that's it. Problem's gone. Solved. Issue over.
Hearing this, I wondered how accurate these polygraphs were and whether the system dismissed people unfairly.
And
how long ago was this?
It's been about a five-year process. So we had the same policy in this reserve, and lo and behold, I got a phone call that a rhino had gone down on our property
late one afternoon, the guys had gone out on their drive, and I got a radio call from one of the camp staff, and they said that the guide is looking for me and that it was an emergency. So I called him on the radio, and he informed me that he had found a dead rhino.
This is the manager of the lodge who was on duty at the time, and whose name I also can't tell you.
He hadn't seen the full carcass. He just saw basically the leg sticking up out of the grass. He had no idea whether it was poached or if it died of natural causes, but he didn't want to approach the carcass. He had guests on the vehicle as well. So I then said to him, it's fine. I will then get in contact with the reserve's warden, and he must just carry on with his drive and leave the area. When you approach a carcass like that, you immediately suspected. So I didn't want him to get close. We didn't know the facts. I didn't want guests to see it. So I said to him that he must then leave the area. I contacted the warden. The warden then came and picked me up, and we went out to the site.
Not to be confused with conservationists. Game wardens are law enforcement agents who patrol conservation areas and waterways to enforce laws specific to wildlife, hunting, boating, and fishing. The warden here is in charge of this private game reserve in which various lodges are located, and in this case would manage the investigation.
Just before you go on, what was going through your mind at the time when you got that call?
I wouldn't say I was shocked, but I was hoping that it wasn't a worst case scenario, that it was actually just a rhino that had been killed in a fight. When something like that happens on your watch, it's not a great feeling. I didn't hear any shots or anything like that, so I was almost in my mind, I was sure it's just a natural death, everything's going to be okay. At first we struggled to find the carcass, but we could smell it, and the anti-poaching guys actually found it and called us, and then we approached it and we saw that the horns had been hacked off. And at that point, when you're faced with the realization that it actually is the worst case, I think you go through every emotion that a human can go through, because you had hope. It's sadness when you see it. It's anger because someone's done it. It's fear because it was so close to home. You know, those people are around. That moment of seeing it was one of the hardest things that I've ever had to go through.
When you saw it physically, was it quite mutilated, or what was the state of the rhino?
It was mutilated. It was, the horns were hacked off with an axe. It was a mess. It was just hacked and lots of blood, and it was difficult to see. And then they immediately started looking around the area for tracks or any sign that the poachers had been there. And while I was standing at the carcass, I saw to my left-hand side quite a bit of blood and things in the bushes, and I first thought that it was actually the horn because of the amount of blood. And when I looked closer, it was actually the axe that they used. Obviously what had happened was they'd been disturbed. We were then told to completely clear out of the area and let the anti-poaching guys see if they can follow tracks. That same night we had the canine unit arrive at the camp, and they searched all the staff accommodation, all the vehicles, for any sign, because the horn was gone. I was sitting in my lounge at my house and I was watching YouTube videos, trying to get my mind off what had just happened.
What were you watching?
Funny comedy shows, trying to... Because it just had such an effect that I was just trying to get my mind off it. And I heard voices outside, and I first thought it was on the computer, so I paused it, and I still heard the voices, and at first my body went cold, because I thought it's the poachers, they're here, because I have heard as well where poachers and things do, they come and they hide out in staff quarters, they use staff to get them out, they try to get ammunition and arms from staff. The next thing, a torch was shone on me from the outside. I've got a glass door at the back of my house, and a torch was shone on me. I just put my hands up and I walked, and I just went outside, and it was the anti-poaching and the dogs.
Were you like shitting yourself?
Yes, I was. And especially when I actually saw that it was the dogs and things, you know, because you don't know, was something planted at the house? You just don't know. There's so many thoughts that go through your head. I just remember standing with my hands up saying, come and look, I did nothing, you know. I was very willing to let them search through my stuff, and they did that. I then had to accompany them up to the staff village where they searched through the staff rooms. They asked me if there's anyone that I suspect in this.
What did you say?
There was some staff that I did suspect, and they were the first rooms and things that we looked at, and nothing was found.
What was the staff's sort of reactions to being searched? Were they scared as well?
I think everyone was scared. They were all outside together, all talking amongst each other. I don't think anyone knew what to expect and what's going to happen next. And, you know, are people going to be arrested? Is the horn going to be found?
Did the anti-poaching unit give any indication on when the poaching had happened? Like how many days before this?
Yeah, they had said by the state of the carcass that it had been 2 days. The rhino had definitely been shot. We saw the gunshot wounds and things like that. So we didn't know if it was during the day, if it was at night. Even still to this day, I still think, but we didn't hear any shots. And, you know, so at the time, I didn't notice anything. But after the fact and sitting thinking about it, because it consumed my thoughts. And I'll get to the point where that started. Because now, obviously, once this has happened, we had to get polygraphed by the reserve.
Well, I was shocked. I mean, I was shocked, like, jeez, like, wow. I really didn't think it's going to happen to us.
Here's the lodge owner again.
I really did not see it coming. We in the middle of the reserve. We're not on a boundary, so I didn't expect that. It was like a shock, absolute shock and mayhem. And then I just absolutely started thinking, who the hell was it and how did they come in? And not even beginning to think that someone within my organization could have been part of it. Within a week, investigations and dog sniffers coming in and the intelligence networks working, fingers were pointing back at my lodge. And so then obviously the polygraph policy came into effect. And so we were natural suspects.
Can you just talk me through what it's like having a polygraph test quickly?
Stressful.
Here's the lodge manager again.
You know, because you know that you haven't done anything, but they'll ask you screening questions, and it'll be things like, have you ever stolen in your life? Have you ever lied to get out of trouble? Have you ever lied to someone you trust? And then after that, they ask you poaching related questions, so they can then gauge, because a lot of people, if they're asked have they stolen, they don't want to get in trouble, so they will lie and they'll say no, I haven't. And they can see how you react when you lie, and then when they ask the poaching questions, they can compare. And I remember when I had my test and they asked me if I'd stolen, I said no. And then I was like, but I have. And now I've lied. I have lied. And they ask you these questions 4 times, but in different. And I think now, do I answer truthfully the next time they ask me? Or is that going to just make it worse? And you start panicking, even though you haven't poached or been involved in it. You start panicking and you don't know how that carries through to your other answers when it matters. And I remember sitting there thinking, oh, my heart's really beating. Can they pick that up? Maybe I'm going to slow down my breathing so that my heart rate drops. But then they're going to pick up that I'm slowing down on my breathing. You know, so like it's scary to do that. You know, and I remember after the testing, okay, it's done now. Now we must wait for the results, and getting the results and seeing, okay, I made it through. I was like, okay, thank goodness, you know, and I'm done now for the year. And then this incident happened. And the reserve then sent through a list of people that they wanted, priority list of people that they wanted to do a polygraph test on this incident. And my name was top of the list. And thinking,
I like, this guy is dodgy. Yeah. His test is all over the place.
It makes sense. He did it a week ago. He passed now. he's done, let him. I still remember the date that they gave us to me. So we went through and we did the polygraph test, but the standard polygraph test that we did would last 15 minutes. This incident-specific polygraph test lasts an hour. I went last.
All the staff at the lodge were polygraphed. This was serious, and they were scared. Eventually, the warden informed the lodge that three of their staff members had failed their tests and were now immediately suspects. And what did you feel when you read that?
Complete shock when I found out who it was. Because I still can't believe it. Because it was guys that I even trusted my daughter with. And one of them in particular was my favourite. So it was complete shock. I still can't believe that it happened. And then they had their polygraph test, they failed it. Then they had to go for an interview. And my favourite in particular just did not answer anything. He refused to talk in the interview and he ended up walking out the interview and leaving. And the warden phoned us and said, look, this is what's happened. The guy didn't even say a word. He didn't deny it. Nothing. So they have to come back for another polygraph test. And if they fail that, then they're out. He didn't fit the profile to me. And then I started thinking about it because we like a family here. So you're emotionally invested in the staff. I try to take my emotions out of it. I still fail because I still get emotional about it. But with him, I still can't. With the others, I started to see certain things where one of the guys, he was one of the rangers, had come to me a few weeks before and said how he owes 100,000 rand for building his house. And when I was talking to the warden was saying these guys are getting offered 100,000 rand to poach a rhino. And the night that the rhino was killed, this guy had asked to go and see his wife at one of the next door lodges. So he wasn't here for when the dogs were here to search. So there was these things that I started to see that made me believe, okay, that guy, he can be involved. But the one, I can't see it. And I could only think his family was threatened because he was such a family man, you know, and his kids. He had a little girl the same age as mine and a little boy. And his little boy called me his white dad. They were really like family for us. We'd buy him Christmas presents and birthday presents and all sorts of things, you know. And I just thought his family must have been threatened for him to do this. That's the only way that I can see him doing it is he's protecting his family and he doesn't want anything to happen to his family. And being a parent myself, I would do the same. If someone came and said, listen, if you don't do this, I'm going to kill your daughter. I would do it. And I can only see that that's the reason why he did it. And I tried to talk to him about it. I'd call him into the office and he just wouldn't. And him and I have had deep conversations before. If I did game drafts, I'd always use him as my tracker. And when we'd go off tracking animals, we'd have deep conversations and things. So I've had hard talks with him. And he just wouldn't say anything. He would always just look down at the ground. And I'd say to him straight, did you do it? And he would say, no, he didn't. He didn't. And I said, but you can tell me, was it that your family was threatened? And he just would not say. And then he would cut it short and he would leave. And for me, I just battled to grasp it. And they then had to do the second polygraph test and they failed it again. And the warden then came to the lodge, called us in, and one by one told them that they must leave and that they're banned from the reserve.
And what was that like?
It was difficult. I could see how sad I was and how sad it was difficult. And when we said goodbye to him, I could see his eyes well up. And I just know the impact that it has on that family. Now you've got the mother of their children, who also works here, who's the only one who can work and the only one who can provide for that family.
Is there any part of you that thinks that he didn't do it?
I'd like to believe that there is, but when things start coming out, then it makes sense. And you can see he did. The results all... they all said it was him. So, like, as much as you think, I can't see him doing it, the facts say that he did. So.
Do you feel betrayed by him?
In a way, yes. I think... yes, I hire people on their passion. I want people to be like me. I'm passionate about art here, about the animals, about conservation, all of that kind of thing. And that's who I look for. I hire on passion. And he was one of those. But when your family gets threatened, and especially being a dad myself, you'll do anything for your family.
And do you think that you have created this narrative in your mind that his family was threatened and that there's a chance that maybe they weren't?
No, definitely were. The talking to the warden, definitely his family were threatened. The thing is that we have to remember that the syndicates that are involved, the main guys that are involved in this poaching, it's the same guys who do drug trafficking and child trafficking and all of that kind of stuff. They're horrible, bad people. They would have known that he's a family man and that's the way to get him. And the unfortunate thing is, the first time that you do it, you either offered a hell of a lot of money, which anyone would do. I mean, 100,000 rand, if you look at these people that are earning minimum wage or that are unemployed, 100,000 rand, it's a lot of money for them. That can keep them going for a long time. So they do it once at that amount of money, and once you do it, you're in, and there's no getting out. You can't speak to anyone about help, and you never offer that amount of money again. It goes from 100,000 rand to 500 rand. And if you then refuse, your family's killed, you killed. You know, it's you lose your job, you lose everything, your life's basically over. So definitely, they saw him as a family man. That's the way to get him, and... He was talked into it.
Poaching is part of the intricate web of organised crime and is not dissimilar to the drug or human trafficking trade. Let's pause for a moment to unpack the structure of the poaching syndicates. To be clear, we're focusing on the poaching that occurs here in the Kruger and the surrounding private game reserves in northeast South Africa. There are many different kinds of poaching, of course, but our focus is on rhino poaching in this region. The rhino poaching network involves varying levels of sophistication, from procurement to sale, an international web of bribery and extortion that spreads from South Africa to Shanghai to Slovakia. Passes through the small towns bordering the Kruger and its surrounding game reserves, and the villages of Mozambique. Men who poach are recruited by syndicates, which can operate in different degrees of professionalism. Any man and his axe can attempt to poach a rhino, but those with access to weapons and connections to transport links and officials tend to be the most successful. Senders are usually clued in community members, or those temporarily nearby for contracted work, who recruit or entice locals for a hunt. They provide them with supplies and weapons. The hunt begins with a night incursion into the national park. 2, 3, or 4 recruits, each with distinct roles, the scale of responsibilities within each determining their pay. One carries the rifle and will do the shooting. Another carries an axe to cut off the downed rhino's horn. And the last carries supplies, typically a few litres of water and some bread. Once out of the park, they deliver the horn back to their sender. International wildlife traffickers support the smaller, localised criminal groups, supply weapons or financial aid, and bribe government officials. At this level, wildlife traffickers procure illicit ivory, rhino horn, animal skins, and other products from regional syndicates and smuggle them to major departure points, or receive shipments from abroad and smuggle them into destination markets. It is exported disguised as furniture, plastics, or peanuts in sealed shipping containers, or smuggled via flights as beads, bracelets, or bangles in luggage. The syndicates are highly sophisticated, dangerous, and evidently successful. Okay, back to the story. You were back in Cape Town when the polygraphs and everything were going on. So can you talk me through that period for you, what it was like hearing this news and hearing about who they were, not specifically their names, but like who they were to you?
Complete disbelief. I just had said, just initially I was like the only word I could think of was what the fuck.
This is the lodge owner again.
Yeah, so I just absolute disbelief. Like, it's just, I could not connect those dots. Just didn't make any sense to me.
How did this incident change the culture of this working environment for you and your staff?
There's still a nice family feeling. You start building trust again. Yeah, so for a while you think you can't trust anyone, and then you start feeling like, you know what, not everyone was involved. The time heals, and then you move on.
I would say even to this day, the atmosphere of the camp changed.
This is the lodge manager.
Because you had this feeling of family and that trust was broken, that it just changed how you see people. Like I say, you know, I saw through that it's better not to get emotionally involved in staff to the degree that I had, because if something like this happens, it breaks you. It's like I'm still broken by it, so, and I don't think it will ever go back to how it was before that happened.
Whilst covering this story at the lodge, I spoke to the staff members who undoubtedly had closer connections to the alleged poachers and their families, and who were there at the time. They were all unwilling to talk to me directly about the incident.
I don't know how to explain this. Like, I can say life now, it's really like hard life.
Why do you think that people are doing it? Why do you think that the poachers are doing it?
I don't know what can I say about that.
I can say I don't know, because we don't know how, what do they get in a rhino.
That I don't know. It's more about loving of money, need money, what. Like, I don't know. I can't tell that. It's not about, I don't know.
Yeah. It's been quite interesting talking to everyone since I've been here, because literally every single person won't talk about it.
Okay.
What happened? Like, they have all just said, I don't know. I don't know what to say to that. Like, I just don't have anything to say about that. There's a fear.
Absolutely.
This is the lodge owner again.
You don't want to be seen to be involved in any way, and you don't want to implicate yourself by what you say, you know, because people make judgments, wrong assumptions and stuff. So a few of the ladies that you've spoken to are quite well connected to one of the people who got removed or like banned. So ever since I moved here, there's an undying loyalty to the community, and also a mistrust of white people. And they will never, ever, ever, they might know exactly who it is, and they will never, ever say anything. Never. Because as soon as they implicate, they stand to get ostracized by the community. Their house gets burnt down. So if, you know, it's that whole thing, you're working with the enemy. And that is still very much a culture in those local communities. They will not throw any community member under the bus when it comes to the Western law system, you know, or the boss, or the, you know, whatever. So,
or the white person coming, trying to get information. They're like, who are you?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's easy to forget when you're outside of these communities, families, cultures, that those who poach are more than what they do for a living. They have motivations that we may not understand. These syndicates are like gangs, and whilst their structures may look different, it's always those at the bottom that do the dirtiest of work. They're the ones who have blood on their hands, who are most likely to get caught, and who get paid the least.
And so do you think the kind of public perception that poachers are all evil and we shouldn't feel bad when they're killed doing what they're doing is wrong?
That's a difficult one to answer, because
this is the lodge manager again.
If I look at the ones that were involved with us, so one of them in particular, I could say, yeah, he was evil. But if I look at the others, no, it's desperate people that are either wanting to survive or wanting to look after their family. They're not really the evil ones. The evil ones are the main guys. But I mean, I remember the warden telling me when they had those interviews with the guys that failed the polygraph test, they would ask them, you know, what do you think should happen to the poachers? And they would say, and even the one that I struggle with, he said that they should be killed. And when the warden said, and what should happen to you, he said he should be killed. I don't think that you can lose empathy for the people that are doing it. I'm sure there are some poachers that are evil and that you shouldn't have sympathy for and things like that, but I think majority of them are desperate people. I just look at our staff, they've got huge families, they've got like 4 or 5 children, and I just look, I've got one child and the strain that that puts on me. And yeah, you've got these big families, and for them, in their culture, kids are important. You know, the kids are the ones that are going to look after them when they're older. And, you know, so I think it's wrong to lose that empathy. Before this happened, I would have been like, you know, shoot a poacher if you see him. It must be shoot on sight. But then once it's happened and the people that were involved, then I saw the other side of it. Through this incident, what I saw out of it was those actually aren't the people that should be killed. And, you know, those are the kind of people that need to be helped and you know, maybe caught and rehabbed and things like that, you know. But the proper bad ones are the main guys. Those are that I've got no sympathy for, and they're the ones. But it changed my view of the actual poachers that are out killing the rhinos and taking the horns and things.
It humanized them for you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Cool.
Not cool.
Not cool.
In her essay, The Origin of Others, Toni Morrison said, "Since no one is born a racist and there is no fetal predisposition to sexism, one learns othering not by lecture or instruction, but by example." I left the lodge and began my drive back to the Kruger. I drove through Hazy View, a small community adjacent to the park, where the influx of poaching money has transformed the lives of a select few, yet created an aspirational atmosphere. Ornate and extravagant front gates mark the entrances to multi-story mansions, some with Colosseum-style columns and multi-car garages, which remain open to reveal the prized vehicles within. These houses don't feel so unfamiliar to me. They're similar to those of family friends in gated communities back in Joburg, or of friends' families back where I grew up in Sydney. It was only when looking at them in the context of this rural, economically disadvantaged town that I realised how truly out of place they were, what anomalies they were. So, Greg, so close to the end of me asking you all these questions.
Yeah, I'm a little bit, happy about that.
Yeah, I bet. It's my last night in South Africa. Tomorrow morning, I'm heading over the border to Mozambique, to a village not far from where we are now. For Greg, pretty much all of the people who poach that he comes into contact with have come from Mozambique, since his section hugs the border between the two countries. Sabi, where I'm going, is known as a hotspot for people who poach. Their proximity to the park, their skills in hunting, as well as the lack of other opportunities available there, makes residents of Sabi particularly susceptible to getting involved in poaching. I want to know what Greg thinks about my trip ahead.
It's the eve of my departure to Mozambique. No first-hand experience. So how are you feeling about me going to Mozambique?
Well, firstly, I'd say Mozambique is a great country. It really is. It's just an amazing country. I mean, I've only seen sort of the southernmost parts of it, and the trips that I've been there have been remarkable and memorable. Amazing beaches, sort of like this Afro-European vibe going on. There's a lot of, obviously, Portuguese influence going. It's a very exciting country. It's great. You know, where you're going and where you, and with the topic that you and the discussion that you're seeking, I think it's going to be very, very interesting. It'll be interesting to see if people are open to actually talking to you about it. You're going to go to places that, yeah, where the bosses sit and recruit their guys and, you know, arrange this and arrange that. And I'd love to be a fly on the wall. And, you know, even if it was just for sort of just to delve into their psychology and what are they thinking. Look, you're going to come back from this with a whole lot more understanding than I do. I'm not in a position to go across and, you know, ask those questions. We go across to meet our counterparts, but when we do, we don't advertise the fact that we rangers here in the Kruger. So we're not in a position to go and ask the questions that you can. I'm very interested to hear what you come back with and what the perceptions that I have based on what I hear from colleagues and poachers that we arrest and so on. I've got these sort of perceptions, and if those perceptions are actually right, and I believe they are.
Do you feel worried at all about me challenging those preconceptions?
It doesn't make a difference at the end of the day. Their motives and we're still losing rhinos. I truly do believe that it's based on greed. People just want money, and not necessarily to support their families, but to live the good life. I truly believe it. Now, from what I've seen, that's what I understand. If that's not the case, it's actually immaterial, because I'm not going to view a poacher that's coming in here to shoot rhino any differently. I'm going to just do exactly the same story. And whether I sympathize with him more because maybe he's feeding his family, that might happen, but I'm still going to arrest him, you know, and I'm still going to trust the judicial system to put him in jail for 15 years. So no, it's not going to make any difference to how I do my job. I don't believe. 99% of the time, those guys who are doing that are not doing it to support their families. I can tell you right now, and I think you'll confirm it when you're there. They're youngsters, and they want the good life. They want the flashy cars, and they want the girls, and the cool houses, and that's what it's about.
Do you think about the fact that what they want is what, you know, a lot of
Westerners and Europeans and white people, I guess, globally have and take for granted that that is something within their reach. Whereas for these people, they're born into poverty, that they see it on TV, social media shows them all the time, all of this excessive wealth that they just don't have a pathway to without going into an illegal industry.
Perhaps, yeah. Yeah, I guess so. You know, you're talking about people who don't necessarily have any sort of schooling or quality schooling. You know, they're not highly employable. So, yeah, perhaps it's the one avenue that would give them that opportunity to have the wealth that they see. If that's the case, though, to be honest with you, it doesn't change anything. For your purposes, it would be really interesting to delve into that and to explore that and to find out, you know, what it is that's going on. But at the end of the day, for me and for everyone here, we still got this issue. The motives doesn't change anything. We're still losing rhinos. You know, that's the bottom line. It's not going to impact us and how we go about our job in any way. I haven't found an ounce of sympathy for a single poacher since I've been here that we've arrested or caught.
Really? Not one ounce?
Not an ounce, no. Because I've seen the brutality and the ugliness behind it. You just have to see it the once, and you cannot gain an ounce of the sympathy for the perpetrator of that.
Sophie and I had a conversation the night before I went to Mozambique about my inability to confront some of the topics we are trying to explore in this series. The fact that I am hesitant to talk about race with white contributors, particularly my family. This is how invisibility and power work.
You know, how do you assess value? How do you judge?
That's Professor Abina Busia. She's a Ghanaian writer, poet, feminist, lecturer and diplomat. Abina is an associate professor of literature and English and of women's and gender studies at Reuters University. She grew up mostly in England and studied at Oxford University, where she did her dissertation on images of Africa in post-war popular fiction.
It is important to preserve the earth and have respect for species, but very often those of us of African descent become really self-conscious when we seem to be operating in contexts in which our lives never matter. Our lives are of less importance than a rare species of rhino or special species of lion. And it is much easier to mobilize to preserve extinct creatures than to mobilize around a sense of justice or a decent way of living for us of people of African descent. The women who established Black Lives Matter hit on something very, very profound, which the contemporary world has difficulty facing. And that is that a certain notions of difference have become hierarchized and invested with differential power. And I think this is what makes it hard for well-meaning, well-intentioned liberal people to understand about the foundations of the movement, because Black Lives Matter is talking about institutional intersectionality, not personal racism. Racism needs to be learnt, and when it is challenged, it needs to be unlearned. But when you don't recognize that your learning has been racialized, you are resistant to unlearning it. In particular, in contexts in which you are struggling for something that you consider good. It is hard to see sometimes that your fight for the good can mask a different struggle for the best.
I've spent over a month in South Africa, immersed in the lives of my cousins Tam, Greg, their kids Ben and Sophia. But I knew to understand this story, I had to get to Mozambique. The stories I've heard, both from media accounts and people's mouths, paint the men who poach as vicious, merciless killers. I had to find out for myself. The night before I left South Africa, I got a voice memo from my translator in Sabi. His name is Domingos.
Hello, good morning, Georgina. I didn't mean to get you scared yesterday. I'm really sorry. But actually, that's the kind of reality around here. Because yes, the work we're going to do, it is actually sensitive. I think we're going to be fine. I think you're especially going to be fine. Just chill out. And, well, I will be pointed some fingers, actually, because I'm bringing someone and talking about things. So I will be pointed fingers, but, like, I believe everything's going to be fine. I'm just thinking here. I think it's going to be fine. Just relax. Let's do this.
Who we are determines the access we have to the world. Because I am who I am, my dad is my dad. His brother is Tam's dad, and Tam is my cousin. Because Greg is her husband, and Greg had a dream to relocate his family to work in the Kruger. And because now his job is to fight for the life of the rhino, I can make this documentary. Who I happen to be gives me access to the conflict in the Kruger, to this story. Tam and her family are my vantage point. I was sleeping in their home, trailing them at work, watching them parent their kids. But your vantage point determines your view. They were my vantage point. Or they were initially.
Invisible Hand was co-created and written by Georgina Savage and Sophie Side in partnership with Case File Presents. It was produced and edited by Georgina Savage. Research and narration written by Sophie Side. Graphic design by Marco Vuleta Djukanov. Original score, sound design and soundtrack by me, Issa Williams. Archival material used in this episode was sourced from ABC News, USA, Tomo News, African Diaspora News Channel, WTHR News, and WhatsApp Radio Show. And to play us out, a collaboration with Kaidi Akanibi with a track titled Cruising Kruger. Mm.